American University at from WAMU at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandy. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with The Current newspaper, who tomorrow evening, Saturday evening, will be moderating some kind of debate in Fairfax County. Who's debating, Tom?
Well, some debate of whether I should be the moderator. No, actually, this is going to be very interesting. This is the very first debate in the June 13th Democratic primary for governor between Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam and Tom Perriello, the candidate who jumped in just in January and was on our show in January. This
Former
is their very first. They're
going
to have their first face-to-face debate at the Lanier Middle School in Fairfax County. It's outside the Beltway, so I have to leave right after this show in order to get there Saturday night. and then they'll be debating in Roanoke a week later. So we're heading up to the primary, June 13th. Very big moment in the time next couple of weeks for the who's going to be the next governor of Virginia.
Well, I suspect that I'd like to wish both candidates good luck, but I suspect you'll need more good luck than they will, even finding your way there.
Waze is a wonderful...
it's a wonderful app to have on your phone. Tom, exactly who in Ward 8, who's an ANC, lives there and who does not? There has been an accusation from an ANC commissioner there, Paul Trantham, who... describes himself, and I guess is a private investigator, but apparently, despite being a private investigator, he presented no hard evidence to what office did he report it to? The Board of Elections.
The Board of Elections.
The Board of Elections. There was no evidence.
Well, this was something in the city paper's Loose Lips column that, for a long time, people have complained. I think there were complaints that Brandon Todd in Ward 4 didn't live in the ward, and he didn't there. And there was a variety in that. Going back to Wilhelmina Rolark, put on your history hats, Wilhelmina Rolark in Ward 8, that she and her husband had some house out in the burbs where they really spent time, that kind of thing. So here's the bottom line on this. If someone has evidence that someone is purporting to live in the District of Columbia and is not living in the district and there's evidence to show it, then show the evidence. Don't talk about it. Say you've got it. Let's see it. And the Board of Elections says, it's up to somebody to make a formal complaint, and then they'll investigate it. It's a serious thing. Our borders are way too leaky for a lot of things, and our elected officials should, in fact, live in the city.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Rich Madalino. He's a Maryland state senator. Right now in our studio, our guest is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a member of the D.C. Council, a Democrat representing Ward 5. He's chairman of the Committee on Business and Economic Development. Kenyon McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for the council member, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. You can watch the live video stream there and ask questions or make comments. You can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at kojoshow. Are you surprised about the accusations in Ward 8? Is that the normal back and forth that goes between rivals who are either running for office or thinking of competing against one another?
As a veteran as you guys are in D.C. politics, you know it's rough and tumble here in the District of Columbia, so I'm not in the least bit surprised by those types of allegations. They generally do rise to the surface about this time. Every 2 years or so. So, no, I'm not surprised.
Well, let's
by
be
it.
Clear. You live in the city, right? Do you live on like 16th Street?
I live in the 2600 block of North Capitol Street. It's the same house that's been in my family for more than 65 years. I don't plan on going anywhere anytime soon.
Okay. Tom Sherwood, two aspects of the ongoing metro mess. One of them is the union is protesting, in many respects, Metro's sick leave policy because Metro apparently suspected that there would be a sick out planned for today. So they denied all applications for sick leave that were made, I guess, about Wednesday. I did not know of the existence of this policy before. I haven't heard it ever anyplace else because people, as a general rule, don't know when they're going to get sick. You know when you're going to have a medical procedure or you're going to see a doctor. But what is your understanding about the origin of this?
Well, the origin of the policy. For management purposes. First of all, there were like 10 times the number of people asking to be off on Friday for sick leave. But this doesn't mean that you have to know 5 days in advance that you're going to have the flu, or that you don't, or going to have a bad cold, or a child's going to get sick. But this is, there are medical reasons. Sick days can be taken for medical reasons. I mean, you can go in for a colonoscopy or something like that. There are any number of reasons you take a sick day. So this kind of a misunderstanding in the world of media about what the sick days were. And this was an internal memo from the Metro staff that this was happening. And the union was warned that, you know, don't do this. It'd be a violation. And, of course, it would be if it were an orchestrated sick leave because they have a no-strike policy. So, but you know, this has been a bad week for Metro, not only because Red Line literally was on fire, but you had the union, which is in intense negotiations with Paul Weatherfield, the general manager. And so they were demonstrating in and outside the building downtown. But also you had Mr. Weatherfield, who's been in office now 18 months. Some of the glow is wearing off, and the board members, surprisingly, were pretty tough on him about, what are you doing this? What are you doing that? The federals, you know, the feds are constantly finding things wrong with Metro. I think it's just part of the downward spiral. I was asking one person, could this be the end, beginning of the end of Paul Weatherfield staying on at the board if the board members are going to hammer on him like they did him and his safety officer?
Has there ever been a general manager at Metro since Carmen Turner who was not hammered on by just about everybody?
Well, you know, as I'm on this program, I've hammered every person, and Mr. McDuffie, I've hammered every person who's served on the Metro board to contribute in one way or another to get us to this point.
Okay.
40, 50, whatever years it is.
Before we
and
get
just
to
for the record, I've never served on Metro's board.
Would you like to?
Would you like to be the general manager of Metro?
No.
Is that a job that you would like?
I would like to get to the bottom line and deal with the issues that Metro's been facing for several years and to figure out a way to get some dedicated funding for the system. Ultimately, I think we've got to restore the public's ridership's confidence in Metro that it's safe and it's reliable, and we have to have the dedicated funding to be able to do so.
Yeah, but the problem is everybody agrees that that's the right policy, but no one, it's kind of like the Republicans on the House trying to come up with a repeal Obamacare. They all know what they want to do. They can't figure out a way to do it, and that's where we are with Metro. I mean, I'm going to bring that up in the debate in Virginia tomorrow. It's where is Virginia? Are we going to have to let, you know, the trains fall off the track out of Dulles Airport before Virginia acts?
Yeah, I can't speak for Virginia or for Maryland. I do chair the board of the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, and we did come out with a report just a couple of days ago that recommended a 1 cent sales tax, a regional sales tax, essentially, which I think is probably one of the more equitable ways to distribute and generate the revenue that's necessary to make a dedicated funding to be able to do the infrastructure and capital improvements that are so sorely needed and have been deferred for several years in the past, which has led us to where we are today. And so I think Mr. Weatherfield has been working really hard to try to overcome some of the things that he inherited when he started. And obviously the arching incident back in January 2015 didn't help, and obviously, you know, it caused a lot of consternation amongst ridership, and we have not yet gotten to that culture of safety and reliability that has restored the confidence in ridership, and we have to get there. We can't just keep raising ridership and fares and cutting service and expecting that we're going to restore confidence.
It's a downward spiral.
As chairman of the Committee on Business and Economic Development, you have been leading the charge on the council to regulate home sharing services like Airbnb. There was an 8-hour council hearing Wednesday on a bill that you introduced. What is the centerpiece of your proposal that would differ from the current rules around home sharing?
Well, actually, Kojo, there are very few current rules around home sharing, and that's largely the problem. There's no clear regulatory framework that is in place right now. What came out of the hearing was testimony from the director of the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, essentially that they have issued several licenses for short-term rentals, but there's no such endorsement for a short-term rental. And so they've issued licenses for bed and breakfasts, for other things, hotels, motels, for boarding houses, and then all these different categories, but there's no category for short-term rentals. And so this centerpiece of this bill is to establish a category and a more streamlined process for people who want to engage in the business of short-term rentals so that they can go down and get a license without a headache and know clearly what they need to do. But it also addresses what I think are our broader issues around the serious housing constraints that we have here in the District of Columbia. And I think I've really been trying to emphasize that every single time a person takes a long-term rental unit off of the market in favor of a more lucrative short-term rental. And I'm not suggesting that everybody's making, you know, money hand over fist, but you have landlords who have seen this as a way to engage in commercial activity and profit from it. And when they take those long-term rental units off the market in favor of short-term rentals, it puts pressure on the housing stock in the District of Columbia. And at the end of the day, it leaves district residents with higher rents and fewer affordable housing units.
You had a boisterous hearing. Bottom line, if I'm an individual homeowner and I have a room or two even I want to rent out, under your legislation, would I, and I think this might be most of the people who are doing this, would that person, would I be required to get a license?
Tom, if you are a primary resident, let me start
here. I live
here.
In my house.
Let me start here.
Okay.
If you're engaged in the business of short-term rentals today in the District of Columbia, you're required to have a license. There's a misconception, and people came down to testify and said, yeah, they're doing Airbnb today, and they don't have a license. Well, they're doing so in violation of the law. And I'm not suggesting that they're intentionally circumventing the law. In some cases, people attempted to get licenses, but just didn't know how and wasn't really getting much support from DCRA.
Exactly what kind of license would be required today? Because at the beginning, I thought this was not regulated, that this home sharing was not regulated at all, but there is a requirement for a license right now.
There is a requirement for a license. The issue is people have applied for a license and have been given licenses for different things. And one of the questions I asked was, if I live at a place and I want to do short-term rentals and you gave me a license for a bed and breakfast, which they did, the person next door who's doing short-term rentals may have gotten a license for something completely different.
If I rent a room in my house, I've got an extra room and I rent it to you, I have to have a license to do that?
You have to have a license. This law went into effect earlier this year. If it's considered de minimis business activity of less than $2,000, then you don't have to have a license. But that just went into effect in March of this year. Oh. Prior to that, you did have a license in order to be able to do that. But let
DCRA
me be clear.
Couldn't possibly regulate this.
Well, he's looking to clear this up. So how would you clear that?
Let me just say, if this bill is passed and you live in your home and it's your primary residence and you have 1, 2, or 10 rooms in your homes that you want to rent out, you'll be able to do so 365 days a year. If you live
with a license.
With a license.
With a specific license for
a short-term rental.
Okay.
If you live in your home and it's your primary residence and you have an English basement that you want to rent out through Airbnb or some other short-term rental platform, you would be able to do so 365 days a year under this bill with a license. What it would prohibit are individuals who don't live in their primary residence who would like to rent out a home that they own through one of the short-term rental platforms. The other more controversial issue that we've talked about at the hearing was, if you live in your home and it's your primary residence and you want to rent it out, either a room or multiple rooms or an English basement, and you want to leave your home and rent it out while you're away, which we've been referring to as vacation rental, then there's a 15-day cap under the current draft. What I've indicated is I am open to, and I've talked to the chairman about this and my other colleagues, I'm open to increasing the number of days that a person who lives in the home as a primary residence who would like to rent it out through a short-term rental platform while they're away, increasing the number of days in which they would be able to do so.
Now it's just a Wild West situation. Nobody knows who's doing what. And
nobody knows who's doing what.
Airbnb is not the only company in the home sharing business, but Airbnb has become shorthand for the industry, and they are pushing back hard against the possibility of regulation in ads that are flooding the airwaves here. So put on your earphones and give a listen to one of those ads.
When the economy crashed in 2008, you know, it devastated a lot of people.
Airbnb at first was a way out. I didn't know exactly how I was going to keep this house. Been here since I was 4 years old.
It's keeping people in their homes. It's also allowing to keep up with the higher cost of living.
I'm someone who lives in this area. I've invested in this area. The extra income has meant a lot for me.
Well, these ads suggest that Airbnb or this sharing arrangement is allowing people to stay here when they may not have been able to stay here. Would your regulation prohibit any of that?
If a person lives in their home and it's a primary residence and they're trying to rent their home out in order to make some extra income through Airbnb or some other short-term rental platform, they would be able to continue to do so under this bill if it were passed. And I think there's something that we should really note. There is a bit of irony here, though, because you know, you're hearing from folks who are living in their homes who say that they need to use these short-term rental platforms to make some extra income because it's so expensive to live here. But when these people are not the individuals who are just simply trying to make some extra income, primarily, though, the individuals who are engaging in buying multiple homes or buying apartment buildings in order to list them through Airbnb, they're the ones who I think are having a negative effect on our housing stock in the District of Columbia. Those individuals who live in their home, who wouldn't otherwise be renting out a room on the regular rental market, they aren't the ones who are putting the pressure on our housing stock. In fact, if they live there at their home, they will continue to be able to rent out while they're present, their homes or rooms under this new bill.
You're not going after so much the homeowner as the people who are trying to make a big business
exactly.
out of this. Now, Attorney General Carl Racine this week filed suit against a company that has multiple units and were listing them on Airbnb, and they're taking
Absolutely.
Them, and they were subject to rent control apartments, and that gets to your issue of reducing the housing
stock. Let me be clear.
Stock.
That is the allegations in Attorney General Racine's complaint against Genosha USA. Is that they were engaging in putting houses on the market through short-term rental platforms, and they were doing so in cases where some were rent control. That's already illegal.
Right.
And so he's going after them under something that's already illegal. But
you mentioned that you'd be prepared to be flexible on the 15-day limit, but just how flexible? We got an email from Kathy, a Ward 2 resident, who says, "You claim your bill is not designed to target D.C. residents who Airbnb the homes they live in, yet the bill limits people who share their whole home to less than 15 days a year. Many D.C. residents travel regularly for work, family, or study. Why shouldn't they be allowed to share their homes for up to 183 days per year, because that's the legal limit for something to be your primary residence?"
Well, there's also a law in the books that defines transient individuals as people who stay in the district for less than 90 days. And so if you're sharing your home for the same individual for more than 90 days, then there's a question of whether or not you're already in violation of the law. But if you're doing it to multiple individuals and you'd like to do it up to 188 days, what we've heard from residents, concerns that have been raised with my office and me in particular, is how that fundamentally changes the nature and the integrity of neighborhoods that are meant for residents to live there, right? And so you've got all these transient people who are coming in. We've heard about significant quality of life issues, whether from party houses to, you know, a lot of increased parking issues, traffic. We've heard about, in some cases, violence against people who live there or with transients who are renting homes out on Airbnb. And I'm not suggesting this is the case for all the hosts on Airbnb, but these are significant issues that we have to tackle. And if you're talking about having transients in your home while you're away for half a year, how is that going to impact the quality and integrity of these neighborhoods in the District of Columbia that are meant for residents to live there?
Look, I want to ask tax. This is Mark Seagraves, Channel 4, covered this Wednesday, and it sounds like a huge issue. If I'm that individual homeowner with a room and I get a license and I rent it out, do I pay taxes to the city on the income I get?
Airbnb yes, right. alleges that they are.
Well, I want to get to that moment, but technically that homeowner should report the income, both federal and state.
You should be reporting your income. Absolutely,
but,
no question.
But it turns out Airbnb has what I can only call a secret agreement with the Office of Tax and Revenue that it will voluntarily pay the taxes of all its members in the city, but it only decides how many people are paying, what the amount will be. And so Chairman Mendelson, when this was brought up in the hearing, Mendelson asked repeatedly to Airbnb, "We want to see that agreement. We want to see it." And they wouldn't. They said, "We'll work on it. We'll get to it."
Get
and then
time.
Also Office of Tax and Revenue, just to close the loop, Mark called Office of Tax and Revenue. They said it is a confidential agreement and that we cannot share it, but Airbnb can. I don't know how many of those agreements but that sounds
so
like
get this. My office, I asked specifically the Office of Tax and Revenue to show it to me as a council member, somebody who's elected and who legislates in the city, and they told me that it was a secret agreement and that they couldn't share it either. And so Airbnb said that they would share it. Mr. Burns, who represents Airbnb, said he would get back to the council.
Is that Will Burns?
That's his name, Will
you
Burns.
Know, he's a former Chicago councilman. Did you know that?
I did know that. He's a former Chicago alderman, yes.
Alderman, right.
Mm-hmm. Here
but anyway, let me finish that thought.
Sure.
If we're going to collect taxes from organizations and people, we ought to know the basis on what that money is collected. And now it's right now a big secret.
Precisely.
Here is Jonathan in Northeast Washington. Jonathan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kodjo. My question's for Councilmember McDuffie. I'm wondering, you know, if someone has a second residence that they've come to own in the district, whether perhaps it was their first home and they've were able to get a second home and now they would like to rent that out, are you suggesting that, you know, they could essentially rent it out for 30 days at a time with, say, a month-to-month lease, but that if they were to want to rent that out for 14 days to someone, that that wouldn't be okay because then it would be a vacation rental? Do you draw the line there for, you know, what's fair to legislate about and what's not?
Thank you for the question, Jonathan. This is one of the things that came up a few times at the hearing. Under the bill that is pending before the council, if you live in the district and you have a second home, you would not be able to rent out a second home through Airbnb or any other short-term rental platform. What I think that a lot of people sympathize with, and I sympathize with, are those homeowners who live in their home and it's their primary residence, but they're finding it hard to make ends meet, and they're using short-term rentals to try to help pay their mortgage or save up a little money. When you talk about people who have a second home or a third home or a fourth home, then you start to talk about the impact that it has on our local rental market, because, again, every home that's taken off of the long-term rental market in favor of short-term rental, it puts added pressure
on our
housing.
How about the argument? Well, it's my home, and I should be able to do what the heck I want with it.
Well, let me say it this way. Brian Chesky, he's a co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. In an interview last month, he said himself, when considering jurisdictions that have housing constraints, like San Francisco and New York, he thinks that hosts on Airbnb should be limited to renting out only their primary residence. And I agree with Brian Chesky about that.
You're trying to regulate the underground economy.
We're trying to make sure
it's pretty tough.
It is pretty tough. And there are questions about whether or not DCRA has the capacity to do so.
Let me ask you about the hotel unions. They were advertising against this. The hotels say that there's no demonstrable impact on hotels, but they worry about these businesses that act as mini hotels affecting them. This reminds me again of the Uber situation with cab drivers. Cab drivers complained about Uber and Lyft coming into town. The hotels are worried that want them to be regulated like they are. Is that one of the focuses of your...
You've been accused of being a shill for the hotel industry.
I think you guys know me well enough to know that I'm not a shill for anybody. And I'm representing the residents of Ward 5 and broader interests of the District of Columbia's residents. And I think that sensible regulation should never be considered the enemy of innovation. I don't think this bill is the enemy of what Airbnb is trying to do. I've repeatedly stated that. We don't want to put any of the short-term rental platforms out of business, but you know, it's important to note, if there are people out there who are buying multiple homes, who have a second or a third or a fourth home that they would want to rent out through a short-term rental platform, and they want to act similar to a hotel, if you want to act like a hotel, you should be regulated similar to a hotel. Now, I think that when you're talking about individual homeowners who live in their home and it's their primary residence and they're just trying to rent out an English basement or a few rooms in their house, then that's a different situation. And they should be able to do so, and they will be able to do so under this bill.
And we got a tweet from someone who says, do I own my home or am I leasing it from the D.C. government? Is this Cuba? D.C. Council has no right to regulate renting my home or my second home.
Oh, you answer that. You're the council member.
Yes, because Tom Sherwood has been to Cuba.
I've been to Cuba, and we're not comparing it to Cuba. Well, you know that if you own a home, I've owned. There are zillions of regulations and rules for houses and yards and repair and all kinds of things. This is not some space age thing that suddenly
decided. And one of them is that you can't use your home as a hotel.
Absolutely. Right. And there are zoning laws that are in place that restrict certain types of uses. And we don't have the authority, mind you, the council, to change those zoning laws. And so there are a lot of implications about what's going on right now. And homeowners really aren't aware, in some cases, who are renting through these short-term platforms, with their obligations. Currently are insurance, for example. A lot of folks are running through Airbnb and these other short-term rental platforms, and they don't have any shepherd insurance policy.
Their homeowner insurance probably specifically would reject anything.
Probably, like in most cases, homeowner's insurance does not cover this sort of business activity that's taking place in some of these premises. And so that's another issue. And I think the government does have an obligation to make sure that we are regulating and not inhibiting people's ability to use their homes. But when you start to put your home out in the market and invite and solicit people to come and stay there, you know, there are all hosts of issues that we have to deal with, not to least to mention the public health and safety issues that are implicated. When you go to a hotel, hotels have been inspected for all types of things, and you want to make sure that they're safe and habitable. Nobody's going into these people's individual properties and seeing whether or not they're safe and habitable. And people have said to us, well, we have a system that allows guests to rank and rate how our houses are and let the market take care of itself. Well, there's no obligation. These guests don't have an obligation. They don't have to go on and give their opinion about how their stay was. And perhaps there are a lot of people who don't even do that.
Our people, we have something called the homestead tax exemption, that if you live in your home, you get an exemption on your taxes. If you rent out your home a certain amount of time, then you lose that homestead exemption. But again, this is the enforcement, the administrative enforcement of this sounds mind-boggling.
And I'm really interested in the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs being a bit more proactive in trying to figure out a better way to provide information to homeowners who are currently renting out their homes through Airbnb and the other short-term rental platforms.
Taxes were mentioned. At least two of your council colleagues want to delay Mayor Muriel Bowser's proposed tax cuts. They say the money would be better used for education. Those tax cuts were approved by the council 3 years ago, triggered when the district generated enough surplus revenue. Should the council delay the tax cuts, and would it require passing new legislation to do that?
Two council members, who are they, does it say?
David Grosso and Charles Allen.
There you go.
So it's a great question, and I know there's a lot of interest around this particular issue. I supported the tax cuts that were put in place when we did so, and I know I continue to support them. I do have a question, though, about the estate tax in particular. How many people are going to benefit from that, and what type of revenue would that generate? And how would we be able to use that to impact residents across District of Columbia, particularly in the area of education? So I am actually talking to my colleagues, Councilmembers Allen and Grosso, about that, because I have an interest in how many people would benefit from the estate tax cut, and whether the benefits that are inherent in that particular tax cut can be outweighed by an even larger and broader benefit to the general District of Columbia public, in particular our students and our parents, when it comes to education in our schools.
What about the view that these breaks were all passed with the understanding that they would not go into effect unless the city's revenues grew large enough in order to essentially cover the loss of any money from these tax breaks? And this is like the second or third round. This was the Tax Review Revision Commission that was headed by former Mayor Tony Williams. It had labor, it had business, it had all types of people on there. They were passed. They were passed in good faith. Is it correct and is it right to now say, oh, well, we want even more money. We're going to kill the last part of this tax revision deal that we did 3 years ago and take out and keep the $100 million or whatever it is that goes in effect in January? It seems to me there's a question of fairness there. These tax breaks help a lot of people, not just business.
Well, you said these tax breaks help a lot of people, not just business, and that's the question that I have. I support the implementation of all the other tax cuts that are going to go into effect. The only one that I'm raising a concern about is the estate tax, and I'm raising that particular concern because I'm not sure that it will benefit a lot of people, Tom, and I think it's only fair for the rest of the District of Columbia residents to ask the question what they think we should do in this particular instance. If this only turns out that it's going to benefit a couple of hundred people, a few hundred people, but yet the savings that we could generate from this are enough to really benefit a broader swath of students and parents in our school system, then I think we owe it to the District of Columbia residents.
I want to say the city has more money than it's ever had in its lifetime, and so anyway, I think you'd look closely at that.
Oh, no,
almost out of time, but you recently introduced legislation to help seniors age in place. What would that legislation do?
Yeah, we're calling that the MOES legislation. And so it's essentially maintaining seniors' lawn and landscaping with seniors who have had trouble, obviously, as they age, being able to take care of their own lawns. I recently, just yesterday, I was sitting on the porch with Ms. Earlene Frazier over in Brentwood chatting with her. And her yard is beautifully manicured. I couldn't do it myself. But she talked about how challenging it was for her to be able to make the yard as beautiful as it is. And as she continues to age, it becomes increasingly challenging. So we're looking at whether the Office of Aging, through a grant program, would be able to provide a support for our seniors to let them age in place and be able to continue to have the integrity and really just be able to have the confidence in knowing that they can continue to take care of their yards the way they have for decades. In many of these cases, like Ms. Frazier, they just can't do it anymore because they're getting older. And
what's the estimated cost of that?
We're waiting to get a fiscal impact statement from the CFO's office on that. And once we get it, we're going to bring it to the rest of my colleagues, and we're going to ask for a hearing through Councilmember Bonds' office, who's been, she's been a champion on these types of issues.
Kenyon McDuffie is a member of the D.C. Council. He represents Ward 5. He's also chairman of the Committee on Business and Economic Development. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Coming up next is Rich Madalino. He's a Maryland State Senator representing Montgomery County. You can start calling for him right now, 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Watch our live video stream of the conversation at Kojo Show, or you can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Tom Sherwood, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, has introduced a bill that would require the federal officials who have jurisdiction in D.C. to live in D.C. There would be like U.S. Marshals, federal district court judges, U.S. attorneys. In states, they are required to live in the jurisdiction in which they serve, but that doesn't apply to the District of Columbia. She'd like to change that.
She would like to change it, and it's nice that she'd introduced the bill. It seems like it's common sense that, if you're going to work in an area, represent an area, regulate an area, or be a judge in an area, that you should live in that area, but only in the District of Columbia, which is a reservation in the nation. Is it where people can stay outside of the city? Marion Barry ages ago wanted to have a residency requirement for district citizens, that if you work for the district government, then you should live in the city in which you work. And police officers and firefighters objected to that, and then Congress barred the city from doing it. But it's again goes to the basic place. We are citizens of a place, and I hate it when people refer to us as residents as if we're on some kind of reservation. We're citizens. We have a real place called Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, and people who are overseeing us or working for us, they ought to live here. And they shouldn't live in the nice places in Montgomery County or others with our guests coming up. They ought to live in our city, or they should go work in other places.
Common sense rules apply in the rest of the country. Apparently, they do not apply in the Congress of the United States.
Or in the district. We're the most un-American place in America, the District of Columbia.
Joining us in studio is Rich Madalino. He's a Maryland State Senator. He's a Democrat representing Montgomery County. Senator Madalino, good to see you. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to see both of you today.
A few recent articles have declared that you are, quoting here, poised to challenge Hogan in 2018. Depending on your response to my question, Tom Sherwood can make this conversation last for the rest of this hour. So, when are you declaring?
Well, I'm worried he's going to prep on for his Virginia moderating debate tonight with me, but I'm not sure when I'm going to make an official announcement, but I think Maryland is ready for a change. I think Maryland is ready to embrace some of the issues that I've talked about. I think a lot of people in Maryland Democrats, respect how I've been one of the most, if not the most, forceful voice against Hogan that there's been, and that it is time for someone to step up and push our party forward.
Well, why not announce and let people start gathering for you? Alec Ross just announced. We'll get to him in a moment. But, why not go ahead and jump in? What are you waiting for?
Alec Ross is ahead of you.
No, yeah. What are you waiting? Why does it matter? This is the election. The primary would be next
June.
Next June. So what ducks in a row are you doing in order to make that announcement?
Well, you got to tell friends and family. You want to try to pull a whole campaign together. Look, if you're asking me if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it.
That's a virtual announcement right there.
I haven't made a formal announcement, but there will be one in the future. But
before the end of the year, for sure.
I'm pushing, well before the end of the year, but I'm pushing forward. Later after the show, I'm going to be in Cumberland.
A lot of people aren't. Are you going to go up to the
Western Maryland Democratic Summit?
The summit. Yeah, yes. I was just reading about that. It starts tonight. It's going through the weekend.
Yep.
I know there are people, for people who do not know, Western Maryland Democratic Summit is a big deal. It's like the crab feast on the Eastern Shore. And it's, and everyone goes and they try to win the straw poll. Are you going to be in the straw poll?
I'm going to be in the straw poll. I know some of the other people.
Are you ginning up voters?
Well, I know sort of some of the conversation is other people have been even paying people to get out there to vote. So I'm going to go. I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going to talk to people. So many of the people who have been there are people I've interacted with for years, worked with on a variety of issues, was part of the team that helped ban fracking, which many of them were at the forefront of. Okay. So
this is in Rocky Gap.
This is
you can go
Rocky
to the casino, maybe get some money for your campaign. Yeah,
are you in favor of Rich Maddaleno running for governor of Maryland or
yes,
not? Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Let the record show that this has been the most satisfied Tom Sherwood has ever been
got an answer.
To a potential candidate running for office because, well, Rich Maddaleno basically told us he is. Any more questions on the candidacy, Tom Sherwood?
Well, you've got, I mean, look at the list of people. You know, Rashearn Baker, who I think you respect and know, the Baltimore County Executive, Kevin Kamenetz, if I said his name correctly, former NAACP Director Benjamin Jealous. That's a great name to run for office on. I mean, there are others, John Delaney, the congressman. It's a crowded field. That makes it even doubly hard to stand out in a crowded field, doesn't it? Money will become an issue early on.
At least eight other Democrats are considering running for this post.
We have an excellent field of quality candidates out there who are going to put out a variety of issues that are important for us to debate in Maryland. I think it shows the excitement and passion within the party right now and the desire to have a lot of new voices out there talking
about
issues.
Are you a new voice?
I think if you talk to most people, I have been an outsider in the legislature, but someone who has been willing to get involved in the process, has the scars to show for it, but has pushed positive change in our state. You know, I've been inside pushing for things like marriage equality, the DREAM Act, the end of the death penalty,
minimum wage,
adequate resources for our public schools, for transportation, even if it meant tax increases, the minimum wage.
Kojo, this is very similar to what's happening in Virginia where Tom Dillon, Pelliero, I'm still trying to pronounce his name.
Tom
He's
Pelliero.
Got too many vowels. It's like a Wheel of Fortune contest. But he's saying change, and you know, and then Ralph Northam says, well, look, I've been in the field. I've been fighting all these things that you say you're for. You know, why should we throw? It's kind of a change election cycle that we're hearing in this country and around the country, not just here.
But wouldn't it also be nice to have someone who's wants to bring about change, but has an appreciation for the system?
Right, you don't want to go buy. You don't want to go hire an accountant and say, "I want the least experienced accountant in the room to represent me on my tax returns."
Well, I think as a nation, we are experiencing the idea of when the least experienced person gets handed the keys to the car and we see that what happens as a result. And, you know, those of us in Maryland have been living with that over the last several years, as Larry Hogan was very much in that same mold. And hopefully the people of Maryland in particular are going to sit there and say, we're tired of this as with a governor. We're tired of this as a president. We want someone with the real world experience, someone who actually appreciates and respects the process.
You're referring to President Trump, who this week said, referring to his job, I thought it would be easier.
Yeah, who knew it would be this hard? I mean, the nice part is I understand that governing is hard, and I'm willing to put in the effort to bring about the type of change that we need in Maryland.
Here is Paul in Columbus, Ohio. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Senator Maddaleno. I'm your constituent. It's great to hear you this morning. I just want to ask you, since many would point in the 2014 gubernatorial election to low Democratic turnout being a problem, how would you focus on turning out Democratic voters in three jurisdictions in particular, Montgomery County, Prince George's County, and Baltimore City?
Well, we have to stand up and fight for our values. We have to put out a positive message. I think last time around, one of our problems was we didn't embrace our record in Maryland. We didn't talk about the good things that our hard decisions had resulted in. And we didn't provide a vision for where we were going.
Anthony Brown did a dull campaign.
We were confident at the numbers because, you know, smart people like you say, well, Maryland, look at your advantage in Maryland. Maryland's a blue state. A Democrat is always going to win. That's not the case. you've got to work hard to get those voters out. I mean, Paul just said it. It was the reason why Anthony Brown did not win the election. A lot of Democrats in Montgomery County, Prince George's County, and Baltimore City didn't come out to vote because we didn't give them a reason to come out to
complacent
vote.
Complacent, also.
Well, and when we talk about a positive vision for the future that speaks to all segments of our state, I think you're going to have people come out and vote.
The conservative watchdog group Judicial Watch says you have way too many voters in Montgomery County. They have threatened to sue the state of Maryland. They say there are 25,000 more registered voters in the county than there are total residents of voting age. What do you think is happening there?
Well, it probably comes as no surprise, Kojo and Tom, that I could get into the wonky details if you want to get there.
No,
thanks.
I think seriously what's happening is a concerted effort by the Republican Party in Maryland and around the country to try to disenfranchise people, to try to suppress the vote. And it's quite un-American that we're out there having these battles of trying to restrict people from voting as opposed to trying to open up the doors as wide as possible to get people to participate.
Judicial Watch has targeted 90 counties in 11 states.
Yes, and I'm sure Montgomery County was one of those that was picked in particular because we have a reputation of being a Democratic stronghold. I mean, part of the reason why we have so many more people potentially who are registered are two things we have decided to do in Maryland. And one is to let 16-year-olds register. So they're not 18 yet, so they don't appear that way in the census, but they can be registered to vote so that they're ready for the next election, because we have elections in Maryland just every 2 years. And then if you are serving in the military and out of the county, out of the country, you can remain a voter, an eligible voter in the county.
What about
speaking of 16-year-olds, here's Alex in Rockville, Maryland. Alex, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering how the council member intends to get young people to vote when they feel so disenfranchised in their political system, especially at the local level.
How are you going to get young people to vote when they don't seem to be very enthusiastic about
this
political
system? Tell them they can't vote.
Yeah.
So, that'll work.
So, I think it's incumbent for us to get out there and talk about the issues that motivate young people. I'm not surprised that young people and older people don't show up to vote when they see very little difference between the parties. We're going to be the party under my leadership that's going to be out talking about a college education without debt, job training that is free of charge. We're going to be talking about how we move forward with a cleaner environment so that young people actually get to be around to be old people, whether it's air quality or fighting climate change and what we can do in the state of Maryland. We're going to be talking about building an economy that embraces the 21st century, brings technology to our state and to our state government to improve quality of life. We're going to make sure that young people have a voice in the Democratic Party of Maryland moving forward. And maybe too often we have not.
Larry Hogan, the incumbent Republican governor, says he's managing the state just fine. He's turned back some taxes that he said he would campaign against, that he's managing the state well and that he feels confident going forward. Once you get past this thicket of Democrats, if you're the nominee, what is the precise core issue that you would go at Governor Hogan about?
Well, you need a governor who's going to be engaged in the important decisions that we face as a state moving forward.
He's not?
He's not. Look at how he has worked on the issue of education. He has been completely disengaged, except to push forward for privatization of public schools, vouchers, charter schools. I mean, who is the first member of the Trump administration he embraced warmly in Maryland?
Betsy DeVos.
So all he has talked about is how we can undermine our public education system, as opposed to getting engaged and working harder to bring about the type of change and reform we need to move our state forward and our education system forward. He just sits out there and says, you know, teachers are union thugs.
Why is he so popular?
He's a nice guy when it comes to his image to the public. He hasn't done anything.
And therefore,
people, when you don't do anything, you don't piss off anybody.
And then we should just acknowledge that tomorrow he's having funeral service for his father.
Yes,
so we should keep that in mind while we talk about him politically.
And, you know, his father has a very dramatic and important role in Maryland and national history as being one of the Republicans that spoke out against Nixon and actually voted for his impeachment.
Right.
But when it comes to the governor moving forward, when you go back to that Washington Post poll from a few months ago that said the governor was still personally liked, when asked, would you vote for him? Only 41% of the respondents, most of whom have said they like him, said they would vote for him. 37% said they'd vote for the generic Democrat. That's a huge change from the prior year and not good news for a governor walking into re-election.
Yeah, we got an email from Tina in Bethesda who says, State Senator Rich Madalino has been a champion for the public good, but underlying the difficulties in making progress for the public interest is money. What has the Maryland legislature done to reduce the influence of money in politics, and what would Senator Madalino do in his future in politics to advance that goal?
We have, quite frankly, done too little to limit the impact of money in politics. We have failed to move forward with a public financing approach. And as a result, we have a campaign and a political system that's based upon who can get the money, not who has the best ideas, who's going to lead the state, but who can get the most money in the race. And we have to find a way to break that connection. I'm thrilled that Montgomery County has moved forward with a public financing system that should be a model for the rest of the state of how we could break that cycle, have small donations, match it with public funds, and have a robust debate in the public sphere. And that's what we need to do, because otherwise a handful of people in our state or around the country have the ability to simply buy election after election. Doesn't mean it's always going to be a Republican that wins, but still, it's amazing how few people, as my friend Jamie Raskin once, I heard him say, you know, it used to be that it was the purview of the millionaires. Now the millionaires feel shut out because it's only the billionaires that can be out there having a say. And that is frightening for the future of our democracy.
In that context, what do you feel about Robert in Bethesda, Maryland's question? Robert, ask it, please.
Rich, I'm with MocoVoters.org. Thank you for your public service. Rich, what can you do with great people like Jeff Waldstreicher to get public financing of elections for delegates and senators? And I would add, one person who served in Annapolis told me privately, the most idealistic day you have as a senator or delegate in Annapolis is your first day, and it's downhill from there.
Rich Madalena.
I think we're going to have to put questions to the voters. I think we're going to have to take a look at the entire structure of the General Assembly and think about how will a representative democracy work in the 21st century. And part of that is going to be incumbent upon finding a way to break the connection between money and politics. It's not going to be easy, but we have changed our structure multiple times through Maryland history, where we've had multiple iterations of our approach to the General Assembly, and it's time for us to think through not just public financing, but how redistricting works, how we actually apportion the General Assembly, whether or not it's time to move away from the three-member districts. How do we make sure there is a robust debate within the public sphere that gets people engaged and appreciative of the political system?
You only have about 2 minutes left.
You know, the problem is whether you're running for governor of Maryland or Virginia or wherever else, or the mayor of the district.
I'm not running for governor of Virginia.
I know. But if there's one thing to be uplifting and progressive and new ideas and throw out the old. But legislatures, by their nature, are a thicket of competing interests. And so you can be, as this person just suggested, you can be all excited about making change, but as the President of the United States is discovering, the Congress is a pretty tough place to crack. You'll have the same issues if you're dealing with the Maryland legislature, even though you have a good reputation there.
Well, I think the upper hand that I would have compared to someone without experience in Annapolis is I know these people. I've worked with many of these people. Some are personal friends. Some, I'm sure, can't stand me. But I know what it takes to get people in a room to come to a solution and a compromise and to move forward. I enjoy that about the process. I respect that about the process. And wouldn't it be refreshing to actually have a governor, an executive who respects the legislative process, who wants to be engaged in the legislative process? So part of it is, I think, actually taking the time to respect the people that you have the honor to serve with in state government.
It's hard to fire up people with that kind of speech, though.
Well, we'll see what kind of speeches he makes during the course of the campaign. Rich Matalino is a Maryland state senator. He's a Democrat representing Montgomery County. He will soon formally announce that he's running for governor. Thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Kojo.
That's it for the show today, but we'd like your help in shaping a conversation we'll be doing on Monday's program. You might have heard a story WAMU's Michaela Lefrak put together about how the arrival of President Trump to Washington is affecting local approaches to dating. We're going to be talking about it on Monday's show, and we'd like to know if your current or our current political environment is affecting your dating experiences. Have you made changes to your profile specifically related to politics? Do you have any new deal breakers, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican? Email us at kojo@wamu.org with the subject line dating. We'll share your stories on the air. Again, that will air Monday in the noon hour. Until then, have a great weekend and keep your eyes peeled for news about Tom Sherwood moderating that gubernatorial debate in Fairfax County that starts tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Is it being aired anyplace?
We're going to live stream it on NBC Washington, our website, so people will watch it. It's very good. If I don't come back from Fairfax, send out the police looking for me.
Thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.